Two people met us at the airport terminal, or hut. Their names were Kiri and Moose. And like most Indonesians we met, they were small, willowy slim and healthy-looking, and we had no idea who they were. Kiri was a charming man with a squarish face, a shock of wavy black hair, and a thick black moustache that sat on his lip like a bar of chocolate. He had a voice that was very deep, but also very thin, with no substance behind it at all, so that he spoke in a sort of super-cool croak. Most of the remarks he made consisted of a slow, lazy, streetwise smile and a couple of strangled rattles from the back of his throat. He always seemed to have something other on his mind. If he smiled at you, the smile never finished at you, but somewhere in the middle distance or just to himself. Moose was much more straightforward, though it quickly turned out that Moose was not M-O-O-S-E, but M-U-S, and was short for Hieronymus. I felt a little stupid for having heard it as Moose. It was unlikely that an Indonesian islander would be named after a large Canadian deer. Almost as unlikely, I suppose, as him being called Hieronymus with a silent Hieroni. The person we had been expecting was a Mr. Chondo, who was to be our guide. I was puzzled as to why he alone, among all the Indonesians we had met so far, was called Mr. It lent him an air of mystery and glamour, which he wasn't there to dispel, because he had apparently gone diving. He would, Kiri and Moose explained to us, be along shortly, and they had come along to tell us that. We thanked them, loaded all of our baggage into the back of the pickup truck, and sat on top of it as we bumped away from the arrivals' hut towards the town of Labuan Bajo. We had been told by someone on the plane that there were only 3 trucks on the whole of the island of Flores, and we passed 6 of them on the way in. Virtually everything we were told in Indonesia turned out not to be true, sometimes almost immediately. The only exception to this was when we were told that something would happen immediately, in which case it turned out not to be true over an extended period of time. Because of our experiences of the day before, we made a point of stopping at the Merpati Airlines hut on the way and reconfirming our seats on the return flight. The office was manned by a man with flip-flops and a field radio, with which he made all the flight arrangements. He didn't have a pen, so he simply had to remember them as best he could. He said he wished we had bought single tickets rather than returns, so that we could have bought our return tickets from them. No one, he said, ever bought tickets from them, and they could do with the money. We asked him how many people were on the flight back. He looked at a list and said 8. I noticed, looking over his shoulder, that there was only 1 person on the list, other than the 3 of us, and I asked him how he had arrived at the figure of 8. That was simple, he explained. There were always 8 people on the flight. As it turned out, a few days later, he was exactly right. There may be some elusive principle lying hidden in this fact, which British Airways and TWA and Lufthansa, etc., could profit from enormously, if only they could work out what it was. The road into town was dusty. The air was far hotter and more humid than in Bali, and thick with heady smells from the trees and shrubs. I asked Mark if he recognised the smells of any of the trees, and he said that he didn't. He was a zoologist. He thought that he could detect the smell of sulphur-crested cockatoos in amongst it all, but that was all he would commit himself to. Soon, these minor, evanescent odours were replaced by the magisterial pong of Labuan Bajo's drains. The truck, as we clattered into town, was surrounded by scampering, smiling children, who were delighted to see us, and keen to show off a new thing they'd found to play with, which was a chicken with only 1 leg. The long main street was lined with several more of Flores's 3 trucks, noisy with the sounds of the children and the scratchy gargling of the tape-recorded muezzin blaring from the minaret which was perched precariously on the top of the corrugated iron mosque. The gutters seemed inexplicably to be full of cheerfully bright green slime. A guest house or small hotel in Indonesia is called a losman, and we went to wait in the main one in the town for Mr. Chondo to turn up. We didn't check in, because we were meant to be setting off for Komodo directly that afternoon, and anyway the losman was practically empty, so there didn't seem to be any urgency. We whiled away the time in the covered courtyard which served as the dining room, drinking a few beers and chatting to the odd extra guests who arrived from time to time. By the time we finally twigged, as the afternoon wore on, with no Mr. Chondo, that we were not going to be getting to Komodo that day after all, the losman had filled up nicely, and there was a sudden panic about getting ourselves somewhere to sleep. A small boy came out and said they still had a bedroom if we would like it, and took us up some rickety steps. The corridor we walked along to get to the bedroom turned out itself to be the bedroom. We were misled by the fact that it didn't have any beds in it. But we agreed that it would be fine and returned to the courtyard, to be greeted at last by Mr. Chondo, a small charismatic man who said that everything was organised and that we'd be leaving in a boat at 7 in the morning. "What about the goat?" we asked anxiously. He shrugged. "What goat?" he asked. "Won't we need a goat?" "There are plenty of goats on Komodo," he assured us, "unless we wanted one for the voyage." We said that we didn't feel that we particularly did, and he said that he only mentioned it, as it seemed to be the only thing we weren't intending to take with us. We took this to be a satirical reference to the pile of intrepid baggage with which we were surrounded, and laughed politely. So he wished us good night, and told us to get some good sleep. Sleeping in Labuan Bajo, however, is something of an endurance test. Being woken at dawn by the cockerels is not in itself a problem. The problem arises when the cockerels get confused as to when dawn actually is. They suddenly explode into life, squawking and screaming, at about 1 o'clock in the morning. At about 1:30, they eventually realise their mistake and shut up, just as the major dogfights of the evening are getting underway. These usually start with a few minor bouts between the more enthusiastic youngsters, and then the full chorus of heavyweights weighs in with a fine impression of what it might be like to fall into the pit of hell with the London Symphony Orchestra. It is then quite an education to learn that two cats fighting can make easily as much noise as 40 dogs. It is a pity to have to learn this at 2:15 in the morning, but then the cats have a lot to complain about in Labuan Bajo. They all have their tails docked at birth, which is supposed to bring good luck, though presumably not to the cats. Once the cats have concluded their reflections on this, the cockerels suddenly get the idea that it's dawn again and let rip. It isn't, of course. Dawn is still 2 hours away, and you still have the delivery van horn-blowing competition to get through, to the accompaniment of the major divorce proceedings that have suddenly erupted in the room next door. At last, things calm down, and your eyelids begin to slide thankfully together in the blessed pre-dawn hush. And then, about 5 minutes later, the cockerels finally get it right. An hour or two later, bleary and rattled, we stood on the waterfront, surrounded by our piles of expeditionary baggage, and gazed as intrepidly as we could across 20 miles of the roughest, most turbulent seas in the east, the wild and dangerous meeting point of two immense opposing bodies of water, a roiling turmoil of vortices and riptides. It was like a millpond. Ripples from distant fishing boats spread out across the wide sea towards the shore. The early sun shone across it like a sheet. Lesser frigate birds and white-bellied sea eagles wheeled serenely above us, according to Mark. They looked like black specks to me. We were there, but Mr. Chondo was not. After about an hour, however, Kiri turned up to fulfil his regular role of explaining that Mr. Chondo was not coming, but that he, Kiri, was coming instead, and so was his guitar. And the captain wasn't the actual captain, but was the captain's father. And we were going in a different boat. The good news was that it was definitely Komodo we would be going to, and the trip should only take about 4 hours. The boat was quite a smart 23-foot fishing vessel called the Raoda. And the entire complement, once we were all loaded and underway, consisted of the three of us, Kiri, the captain's father, two small boys aged about 12 who ran the boat, and three chickens. The day was calm and delightful. The two boys scampered about the boat like cats, rapidly unfurling and raising the sails whenever there was a whisper of wind, then lowering them again, starting the engine, and falling asleep whenever the wind died. For once there was nothing we had to do and nothing we could do, so we lounged around on the deck watching the sea go by, watching the crested terns and sea eagles that flew over us, and watching the flying fish that swarmed occasionally round the boat. The three chickens sat in the prow of the boat and watched us. One of the more disturbing aspects of travel in remote areas is the necessity of taking your food with you in non-perishable form. For Westerners, who are used to getting their chickens wrapped in polythene from the supermarket, it is an uncomfortable experience to share a long ride on a small boat with three live chickens who are eyeing you with a deep and dreadful suspicion which you are in no position to allay. Despite the fact that an Indonesian island chicken has probably had a much more natural and pleasant life than one raised on a battery farm in England, people who wouldn't think twice about buying something oven-ready become much more upset about a chicken that they've been on a boat with, so there is probably buried in the Western psyche a deep taboo about eating anything you've been introduced to socially. As it happened, we would not be eating all three of them ourselves. Whichever god it is in the complicated Hindu pantheon who has the lowly task of determining the fate of chickens was obviously in a rumbustious mood that day and was planning a little havoc of his own. And then at last the island of Komodo was ahead of us, creeping slowly towards us from the horizon. The colour of the sea around the boat was changing from the heavy, inky black it had been for the last few hours to a much lighter, translucent blue, but the island itself seemed, perhaps to our impressionable senses, to be a dark and sombre mass looming over the water. As it approached, its gloomy form gradually resolved into great serrated heaps of rocks, and behind them heavy, undulating hills. Closer still, we could begin to make out the details of the vegetation. There were palm trees, but in meagre numbers. They were stuck sporadically across the brows of the hills, as if the island had spines, or as if someone had chucked little darts into the hills. It reminded me of the illustration from Gulliver's Travels, in which Gulliver has been tethered to the ground by the Lilliputians, and has dozens of tiny Lilliputian spears sticking into him. The images that the island presented to the imagination were very hard to avoid. The rocky outcrops took on the shape of massive triangular teeth, and the dark and moody grey-brown hills undulated like the heavy folds of a lizard's skin. I knew that if I were a mariner in unknown waters, the first thing I would write on my charts at this moment would be, "Here be dragons." But the harder I looked at the island as it crept past our starboard bow, and the harder I tried to filter out the promptings of a suggestible imagination, the more the images nevertheless insisted themselves upon me. The ridge of a hill that stretched in a thick folding shape down into the water, heavily wrinkled round its folds, had the contours of a lizard's leg. Not in the actual shape, of course, but in the natural interplay of its contours and in the heavy thickness of its textures. This was the first time that I had such an impression, but several times during the subsequent trips that we made during this year, the same feeling crept up on me. Each new type of terrain we encountered in different parts of the world would seem to have a particular palette of colours, textures, shapes and contours, which made it characteristically itself. And the forms of life that you would find in that terrain would often seem to be drawn from that same distinctive palette. There are obvious mechanisms we know about to account for some of this, of course. For many creatures, camouflage is a survival mechanism, and evolution will select in its favour. But the scale on which these intuited, perhaps half-imagined, correspondences seem to occur is much larger and more general than that. We are currently beginning to arrive at a lot of new ideas about the way that shapes emerge in nature. And it is not impossible to imagine that, as we discover more about fractal geometry, the strange attractors which lie at the heart of newly emerging theories of chaos, and the way in which the mathematics of growth and erosion interact, we may discover that these apparent echoes of shape and texture are not entirely fanciful or coincidental. Maybe. I suggested something along these lines to Mark, and he said I was being absurd. Since he was looking at exactly the same landscape as I was, I have to allow that it might all simply have been my imagination, half-baked as it was in the Indonesian sun. We moored at a long, rickety wooden jetty that stuck out from the middle of a wide, pale beach. At the landward end, the jetty was surmounted by an archway, nailed to the top of which was a wooden board which welcomed us to Komodo, and therefore served slightly to diminish our sense of intrepidness. The moment we passed under the archway, there was suddenly a strong smell. You had to go through it to get the smell. Until you'd been through the archway, you hadn't arrived, and you didn't get the strong, thick, musty smell of Komodo. The next blow to our sense of intrepidness was the rather neatly laid out path. This led from the end of the jetty, parallel to the shore, towards the next and major blow to our sense of intrepidness, which was a visitor's village. This was a group of fairly ramshackle wooden buildings, an administration centre from which the island, which is a wildlife reserve, is run, a cafeteria terrace, and a small museum. Behind these, ranged around the inside of a steep semicircular slope, were about half a dozen visitors' huts on stilts. It was about lunchtime, and there were nearly a dozen people sitting in the cafeteria eating noodles and drinking 7-Up. Americans, Dutch, you name it. Where had they come from? How had they got here? What was going on? Outside the administration hut was a wooden sign with regulations all over it, such as report to National Park Office, travel outside visitor centre only with guards, wear pants and shoes, and watch for snakes. Lying on the ground under this was a small stuffed dragon. I say small because it was only about 4 feet long. It had been modelled in a completely spread-eagled posture, lying flat on the ground with its forelimbs stretched out in front and its back limbs lying alongside its long, tapering tail. I was a little startled to see it for a moment, but then went up to have a look at it. It opened its eyes and had a look at me. I rocketed backwards with a yell of astonishment which provoked barks of derisive laughter from the terrace. "It's just a dragon," called out an American girl. I went over. "Have you been here long?" I asked. "Oh, hours," she said. "We came over on the ferry from Labuan Bajo. Done the dragons, boarded them. The food's terrible." "What ferry?" I asked. "Oh, comes over most days." "Oh. Oh, I see. From Labuan Bajo." "You have to go and sign the visitor's book in the office," she said, pointing at it. Rather ruffled, I went and joined Mark and Gaynor. "This isn't at all what I expected," said Mark, standing there in the middle of our pile of intrepid baggage, holding the 3 chickens. "Did we need to bring these?" he asked Kiri. Kiri said it was always a good idea to bring chickens for the kitchen. Otherwise, we just have to eat fish and noodles. "I think I prefer fish," said Gaynor. Kiri explained that she was wrong and that she preferred chicken to fish. Westerners, he explained, preferred chicken. It was well known. Fish was only cheap food for peasants. We would be eating chicken, which was sexy and which we preferred. He took the chickens, which were tethered together with a long piece of string, put them down by our baggage, and ushered us up the steps to the park office, where one of the park guards gave us forms and a pencil. Just as we were starting to fill them in, giving details of our passport numbers, date, country and town of birth, and so on, there was a sudden commotion outside. At first we paid it no mind, wrestling as we were to remember our mother's maiden names and trying to work out who to elect as next of kin. But the racket outside increased, and we suddenly realised that it was the sound of distressed chickens. Our chickens. We rushed outside. The stuffed dragon was attacking our chickens. It had one of them in its mouth and was shaking it. But as soon as it saw us and others closing in on him, it scurried rapidly round the corner of the building and off across the clearing behind in a cloud of dust, dragging the other distraught chickens tumbling along in the dust behind it, still tethered together with the string and screeching. After the dragon had put about 30 yards between it and us, it paused and with a vicious jerk of its head bit through the string, releasing the other chickens, which scrambled off towards the trees, shrieking and screaming and running in ever-decreasing circles as park guards careered after them, trying to round them up. The dragon, relieved of its excess chickens, galloped off into the thick undergrowth. With a lot of after you, we ran carefully towards where it had disappeared and arrived breathless and a little nervous. We peered in. The undergrowth covered a large bank, and the dragon had crawled up the bank and stopped. The thick vegetation prevented us getting closer than a yard to the thing, but we weren't trying terribly hard. It lay there quite still. Protruding from between its jaws was the back end of the chicken, its scrawny legs quietly working the air. The dragon lizard watched us unconcernedly with the one eye that was turned towards us, a round, dark brown eye. There is something profoundly disturbing about watching an eye that is watching you, particularly when the eye that is watching you is almost the same size as your eye and the thing it is watching you out of is a lizard. The lizard's blink was also disturbing. It wasn't the normal rapid reflex movement that you expect from a lizard, but a slow, considered blink, which made you feel that it was thinking about what it was doing. The back end of the chicken struggled feebly for a moment, and the dragon chomped its jaws a little to let the chicken's struggles push it further down its throat. This happened a couple more times, until there was only one scrawny chicken foot still sticking ridiculously out of the creature's mouth. Otherwise, it did not move. It simply watched us. In the end, it was us that slunk away, trembling with an inexplicable cold horror. Why? We wondered as we sat in the terrace cafeteria and tried to calm ourselves with 7-Up. The three of us were sitting ashen-faced, as if we had just witnessed a foul and malignant murder. At least if we had been watching a murder, the murderer wouldn't have been looking us impassively in the eye as he did it. Maybe it was the feeling of cold, unflinching arrogance that so disturbed us. But whatever malign emotions we tried to pin onto the lizard, we knew that they weren't the lizard's emotions at all, only ours. The lizard was simply going about its lizardly business in a simple, straightforward, lizardly way. It didn't know anything about the horror, the guilt, the shame, the ugliness that we, uniquely guilty and ashamed animals, were trying to foist on it. So we got it all straight back at us, as if reflected in the mirror of its single, unwavering and disinterested eye. Subdued with the thought that we had somehow been horrified by our own reflection, we sat quietly and waited for lunch. Lunch. In view of all the events of the day so far, lunch suddenly seemed to be a very complicated thing to contemplate. Lunch, as it turned out, was not a chicken. It wasn't a chicken because the dragon had eaten it. How the kitchen was able to determine that the chicken the dragon had eaten was the precise one that they were otherwise going to do for lunch was not clear to us, but apparently that was the reason we were having plain noodles, and we were grateful for it. We talked about how easy it was to make the mistake of anthropomorphizing animals and projecting our own feelings and perceptions onto them, where they were inappropriate and didn't fit. We simply had no idea what it was like being an extremely large lizard. And neither, for that matter, did the lizard, because it was not self-conscious about being an extremely large lizard. It just got on with the business of being one. To react with revulsion to its behaviour was to make the mistake of applying criteria that are only appropriate to the business of being human. We each make our own accommodation with the world and learn to survive in it in different ways. What works as successful behaviour for us does not work for lizards, and vice versa. For instance, said Mark, we don't eat our own babies if they happen to be within reach when we're feeling a little peckish. What? Said Gaynor, putting down her knife and fork. A baby dragon is just food as far as an adult is concerned, Mark continued. It moves about and has got a bit of meat on it. It's food. If they ate them all, of course, the species would die out, so that wouldn't work very well. Most animals survive because the adults have acquired an instinct not to eat their babies. The dragons survive because the baby dragons have acquired an instinct to climb trees. The adults are too big to do it, so the babies just sit up in trees till they're big enough to look after themselves. Some babies get caught, though, which works fine. It sees them through times when food is scarce and helps to keep the population within sustainable levels. And sometimes they just eat them anyway. How many of these things are there left? I asked quietly. Oh, about 5,000, said Mark. And how many did there used to be? About 5,000, he said. And as far as anyone can tell, that's roughly how many there have always been. So they're not particularly endangered. Well, they are, Mark said, because only 350 of them are breeding females. We don't know if that's a typical number or not, but it seems pretty low. Furthermore, if an animal has a low population and lives in a very restricted area, like just a few small islands in the case of the dragons, it's particularly vulnerable to changes in its habitat, and wherever human beings arrive, habitats start changing pretty quickly. So we shouldn't be here, I said. It's arguable, said Mark. If no one was here taking an interest, the chances are very strong that something could go wrong. Just one forest fire or a disease in the deer population could wipe out the dragons. And there's also the worry that the growing human population on the islands could start to feel that they could very well live without them. They're very dangerous animals. There's not merely the danger of being eaten by one. If you just get bitten, you're in very serious trouble. You see, when a dragon attacks a horse or a buffalo, it doesn't necessarily expect to kill it there and then. If it gets involved in a fight, it might get injured, and there's no benefit in that. So sometimes the dragon will just bite it and walk away. But the bacteria that live in a dragon's saliva are so virulent that the wounds will not heal, and the animal will usually die in a few days of septicemia, whereupon the dragon can eat it at leisure. Or another dragon can eat it if it happens to find it first. They're not really fussed. It's good for the species that there's a regular supply of badly injured and dying animals about the place. There was a well-known case of a Frenchman who was bitten by a dragon and eventually died in Paris 2 years later. The wound festered and just would never heal. Unfortunately, there were no dragons in Paris to take advantage of it, so the strategy broke down on that occasion, but generally it works well. The point is that these things are buggers to have living on your doorstep. And though the villagers on Komodo and Rincha have been pretty tolerant, there has been a history of attacks and deaths, and it's possible that as the human population grows, there will be a greater conflict of interest, and rather less patience with the idea of not being able to go off for a wander without running the risk of having your leg bitten off and your entrails ripped out by a passing dragon. So, as we've discovered, Komodo is now a protected national park. We've got to the point where it takes active and deliberate intervention to save rare species, and that's usually sustained by public interest. And public interest is sustained by public access. If it's carefully controlled and disruption is kept to a minimum, then it works well and is fine, I think. I won't pretend that I don't feel uneasy about it. "I feel very uneasy about the whole place," said Gaynor with a shudder. "There's a kind of creeping malignancy about it." "Ah, just your imagination," said Mark. "For a naturalist, it's paradise." There was suddenly a slithering noise on the roof of the terrace, and a large snake fell past us to the ground. Instantly a couple of park guards rushed out and chased the thing off into the bush. "That wasn't my imagination," said Gaynor. "I know," said Mark enthusiastically. "This is wonderful." In the afternoon, accompanied by Kiri and a guard, we went off to explore. We found no dragons, but as we thrashed recklessly through the undergrowth, we encountered instead a bird. And it was one that I felt very much at home with. I have a well-deserved reputation for being something of a gadget freak, and I'm rarely happier than when spending an entire day programming my computer to perform automatically a task that it would otherwise take me a good 10 seconds to do by hand. 10 seconds, I tell myself, is 10 seconds. Time is valuable, and 10 seconds worth of it is well worth the investment of a day's happy activity working out a way of saving it. The bird we came across was called a megapode, and it has a very similar outlook on life. It looks a little like a lean, sprightly chicken, though it has the advantage over chickens that it can fly, if a little heavily, and is therefore better able to escape from dragons, which can only fly in fairy stories, and in some of the nightmares with which I was plagued while trying to sleep on Komodo. The important thing is that the megapode has worked out a wonderful labour-saving device for itself. The labour it wishes to save is the time-consuming activity of sitting on its nest all day incubating its eggs when it could be out and about doing things. I have to say at this point that we didn't actually come across the bird itself, though we thought we glimpsed one scuttling through the undergrowth. We did, however, come across its labour-saving device, which is something that it's hard to miss. It was a conical mound of thickly packed earth and rotting vegetation, about 6 feet high and 6 feet wide at its base. In fact, it was considerably higher than it appeared, because the mound would have been built on a hollow in the ground, which would itself have been about 3 feet deep. I've just spent a cheerful hour of my time writing a program on my computer that'll tell me instantly what the volume of the mound was. It's a very neat and sexy program with lots of pop-up menus and things, and the advantage of doing it the way I have is that on any future occasion on which I need to know the volume of a megapode nest, given its basic dimensions, my computer will tell me the answer in less than a second, which is a wonderful saving of time. The downside, I suppose, is that I cannot conceive of any future occasion that I am likely to need to know the volume of a megapode nest, but no matter. The volume of this mound is a little over 9 cubic yards. What the mound is an automatic incubator. The heat generated by the chemical reactions of the rotting vegetation keeps the eggs that are buried deep inside it warm. And not merely warm. By judicious additions or subtractions of material from the mound, the megapode is able to keep it at the precise temperature which the eggs require in order to incubate properly. So, all the megapode has to do to incubate its eggs is merely to dig 3 cubic yards of earth out of the ground, fill it with 3 cubic yards of rotting vegetation, collect a further 6 cubic yards of vegetation, build it into a mound, and then continually monitor the heat it's producing and run about adding bits or taking bits away. And thus, it saves itself all the bother of sitting on its eggs from time to time. This cheered me up immensely. And the good mood it put me into lasted all the way back to the visitor's village and up to the precise point when we walked in through the door of the hut, which we had been assigned as sleeping quarters. It was quite large and constructed, as I've said, on stilts, for obvious reasons. However, the wood of which it was built was half rotten. There were damp and stinking mattresses in the small bedrooms, ominously large spiders' webs in all the corners, dead rats on the floor, and the stench of an overflowing lavatory. We tried gamely to sleep there that night, but in the end we were driven out by the sheer noise of the rats fighting the snakes in the roof cavity, and eventually took our sleeping bags down to the boat and slept on its deck. We awoke early, cold and damp with the dew, but feeling safe. We rolled up our bags and made our way back along the rickety jetty and under the arch. Once again, as soon as we'd passed through the arch, the smell of the place assailed us, and we were in that malign other world, Komodo. This morning we had been told we would definitely see dragons. Big dragons. We didn't know precisely what it was we were in, but clearly it was not what we had originally expected. It didn't look as if we would be pegging a dead goat out on the ground and then hiding up a tree all day. The day was to consist almost entirely of things we had not been expecting, starting with the arrival of a group of about 24 American tourists on a specially chartered boat. They were mostly of early retirement age, festooned with cameras, polyester leisure suits, gold-rimmed glasses, and Midwestern accents, and I didn't think that they would all be sitting up a tree all day either. We were severely put out by their arrival and felt that the last vestige of any sense of intrepidness we were still trying to hold on to was finally slipping away. We found a guard and asked what was going on. He said we could go on ahead now if we wanted to avoid the large party, so we set off with him immediately. We had a walk of about 3 or 4 miles through the forest, along a path that was obviously well prepared and well trodden. The air was hot and dusty, and we walked with a sense of queasy uncertainty about how the day was going to go. After a while we became aware of the faint sound of a bell moving along ahead of us, and quickened our footsteps to find out what it was. We rounded a corner and were confronted with some stomach-turning reality. Up till now, there had been something dreamlike about the whole experience. It was as if the action of walking through the archway and ingesting the musty odour of the island spirited you into an illusory world in which words like dragon and snake and goat acquired fantastical meanings that had no analogue in the real one, and no consequence in it either. Now I had the feeling that the dream was slithering down the slope into nightmare, and that it was the sort of nightmare from which you would wake to discover that you had indeed wet the bed, that someone was indeed shaking you and shouting, and that the acrid smell of smoke was indeed your house incinerating itself. Ahead of us on the path was a young goat. It had a bell and a rope around its neck, and was being led unwillingly along the pathway by another guard. We followed it numbly. Occasionally it would trot along hesitantly for a few paces, and then an appalling dread would seem suddenly to seize it, and it would push its forelegs into the ground, put its head down, and struggle desperately against the tugging of the rope, bleating and crying. The guard would pull roughly on the rope and swipe at the goat's hindquarters with a bunch of leafy twigs he was carrying in his other hand, and the goat would at last tumble forward and trot along a few more paces, light-headed with fear. There was nothing for the goat to see to make it so afraid, and nothing, so far as we could tell, to hear. But who knows what the goat could smell in that place to which we all were moving. Our deeply sinking spirits were next clouted sideways from a totally unexpected direction. We came across a circle of concrete set in the middle of a clearing. The circle was about 20 feet across, and had 2 parallel black stripes painted on it, with another black stripe at right angles to them, connecting their centres. It took us a few moments to work out what the symbol was and what it meant. Then we got it. It was just an H. The circle was a helicopter pad. Whatever it was that was going to happen to this goat was something that people came by helicopter to see. We trotted on, numb and light-headed, suddenly finding meaningless things to laugh wildly and hysterically at, as if we were walking willfully towards something that would destroy us as well. Leading from the helipad was a yet more formal pathway. It was a couple of yards wide, with a stout wooden fence along either side, about 2 feet high. We followed this along for a couple of hundred yards, until we came at last to a wide gully, about 10 feet deep. And here there were a number of things to see. To our left was a kind of bandstand. Several rows of bench seats were banked up behind each other, with a sloping wooden roof to protect them from the sun and other inclemencies in the weather. Tied to the front rail of the bandstand were both ends of a long piece of blue nylon rope, which ran out and down into the gully, where it was slung over a pulley wheel which hung from the branches of a small bent tree. A small hook hung from the rope. Stationed around the tree, basking in the dull light of a hot but overcast day, and in the stench of rotten death, were six large, muddy grey dragon lizards. The largest of them was probably about 10 feet long. It was at first quite difficult to gauge their size. We were not that close as yet. The light was too blear and grey to model them clearly to the eye, and the eye was simply not accustomed to equating something with the shape of a lizard with something of that size. I stared at them a while aghast, until I realised that Mark was tapping me on the arm. I turned to look. On the other side of the short fence, a large dragon was approaching us. It had emerged from the undergrowth, attracted no doubt by the knowledge that the arrival of human beings meant that it was feeding time. We learnt later that the group of dragons that hang out in the gully rarely go very far from it, and now do very little at all other than lie and wait to be fed. The dragon lizard padded towards us, slapping its feet down aggressively, first its front left and back right, then vice versa, carrying its great weight easily and springily, with the swinging, purposeful gait of a bully. Its long, narrow, pale, forked tongue flickered in and out, testing the air for the smell of dead things. It reached the far side of the fence, and then began to range back and forth tetchily, waiting for action, swinging and scraping its heavy tail across the dusty earth. Its rough, scaly skin hung a little loosely over its body, like chainmail, gathering to a series of cowl-like folds just behind its long death's head of a face. Its legs were thick and muscular, and ended in claws such as you'd expect to find at the bottom of a brass table leg. The thing is just a monitor lizard, and yet it is massive to a degree that is unreal. As it rears its head up over the fence and around as it turns, you wonder how it's done, what trickery is involved. At that moment, the party of tourists began to straggle towards us along the path, cheery and unimpressed, wanting to know what was up, what was happening. Oh, look, there's one of those dragons. Oh, it's a big one, nasty-looking fella. And now the worst of it was about to begin. At a discreet distance behind the bandstand, the goat was being slaughtered. Two park guards held the struggling, bleating creature down on the ground with its neck across a log and hacked its head off with a machete, holding a bunch of leafy twigs against it to staunch the eruption of blood. The goat took several minutes to die. Once it was dead, they cut off one of its back legs for the dragon behind the fence, then took the rest of the body and fastened it onto the hook on the blue nylon rope. It rocked and swayed in the breeze as they winched it down to the dragons lying in the gully. The dragons took only a lethargic interest in it for a while. They were very well fed and sleepy dragons. At last one reared itself up, approached the hanging carcass, and ripped gently at its soft underbelly. A great muddle of intestines slipped out of the goat and flopped over the dragon's head. They lay there for a while, steaming gently. The dragon seemed, for the moment, not to take any further interest. Another dragon then heaved itself into motion and approached. It sniffed and licked at the air, and then started to eat the intestines of the goat from off the head of the first dragon, until the first dragon rounded on it and started to claim part of its meal for itself. At first nip, a thick green liquid flooded out of the glistening grey coils, and as the meal proceeded, the head of each dragon in turn became wet with the green liquid. "Boy, this makes it big, Pauline," said a man standing near me, watching through his binoculars. "It makes it bigger than it is. You know, with these, it's the size I really thought we'd be seeing." He handed the binoculars to his wife. "Oh, that really does magnify it," she said. "It really is a superb pair of binoculars, Pauline, and they're not heavy either." Other of the group clustered round. "May I take a look? Whose are these?" "My gosh, Howard would adore these." Al, take a look at these binoculars and see how heavy they are." Just as I was making the charitable assumption that binoculars were just a diversion from having actually to watch the hellish floor show in the pit, the woman who now had possession of them suddenly exclaimed delightedly, "Gulp, gulp, gulp, all gone. What a digestive system. Oh, now he's smelling us." "He probably wants fresher meat," growled her husband, live on the hoof. It was, in fact, at least an hour or so before all of the goat had gone, by which time the party had drifted, chatting, back to the village. As they did so, a lone Englishwoman in the party confided to us that she didn't actually care much about the dragons. "I liked the landscape," she said airily. "The dragons are just thrown in, and of course all the strings and the goats and the tourists. Well, it's just comedy, really. If you're walking by yourself and you came across one, that might be different, but it's kind of like a puppet show." When the last of them had left, a park guard told us that if we wished to, we could climb down into the gully and see the dragons close to, and with swimming heads we did so. Two guards came with us, armed with long sticks which branched into a Y at the end. They used these to push the dragons' necks away if they came too close or began to look aggressive. We clambered and slithered down the slope, almost too scared to know or care what we were doing, and within a few minutes I found myself standing just 2 feet from the largest of the dragons. It regarded me without much interest, having plenty already to feed on. A length of dripping intestine was hanging from its open jaws, and its face was glistening with blood and saliva. The inside of its mouth was a pale, hard pink, and its fetid breath, together with the hot, foul air of the gully, combined into a stench so overpowering that our eyes were stinging and streaming, and we were half faint with nausea. All that remained by now of the goat which we had followed as it struggled bleating down the pathway ahead of us was one bloody and dismembered leg, hanging by its ankle from the hook on the blue nylon rope. One dragon alone was still interested in it, and was gnawing moodily at the thigh muscles. Then it got a proper grip on the whole leg, and tried with vicious twists of its head to pull it off the hook. But the leg was still held fast at the ankle bone. Then, astoundingly, the dragon began instead very slowly to swallow the leg whole. It pulled and tugged and manoeuvred itself so that more and more of the leg was pushed down its throat, until all that protruded was the hoof and the hook. After a while, the dragon gave up struggling with it, and simply squatted there, frozen in this posture for at least 10 minutes, until at last a guard did it the favour of hacking the hook away with his machete. The very last piece of the goat slithered away into the lizard's maw, where bones, hooves, horns and all would now slowly be dissolved by the corrosive power of the enzymes that live in a Komodo dragon's digestive system. We made our excuses and left. The first of our remaining chickens made its appearance at lunch, but our mood wasn't right for it. We pushed the scrawny bits of it listlessly around our plates and could find little to say. In the afternoon we took the boat to Komodo village, where we met a woman who was the only known survivor of a dragon attack. A giant lizard had gone for her while she was out working in the fields, and by the time her screams had brought her neighbours and their dogs to rescue her and beat the creature away, her leg was in tatters. Intensive surgery in Bali saved her from having it amputated, and miraculously she fought off the infection and lived, though her leg was still a mangled ruin. On the neighbouring island of Rincha, we were told, a 4-year-old boy had been snatched by a dragon as he lay playing on the steps of his home. The living build their houses on stilts, but on these islands not even the dead are safe, and they are buried with sharp rocks piled high on their graves. For all my rational Western intellect and education, I was for the moment overwhelmed by a primitive sense of living in a world ordered by a malign and perverted God, and it coloured my view of everything that afternoon, even the coconuts. The villagers sold us some and then split them open for us. They are almost perfectly designed. You first make a hole and drink the milk. Then you split open the nut with a machete and slice off a segment of the shell, which forms a perfect implement for scooping out the coconut flesh inside. What makes you wonder about the nature of this God character is that he creates something that is so perfectly designed to be of benefit to human beings, and then hangs it 20 feet above their heads on a tree with no branches. Here's a good trick. Let's see how they cope with this. Oh, look, they've managed to find a way of climbing the tree. I didn't think they'd be able to do that. All right, let's see them get the thing open. So they've found out how to temper steel now, have they? Okay, no more Mr. Nice Guy. Next time they go up that tree, I'll have a dragon waiting for them at the bottom. I can only think that the business with the apple must have upset him more than I realized. I went and sat on the beach by a mangrove tree and gazed out at the quiet ripples of the sea. Some fish were jumping up the beach and into the tree, which struck me as an odd thing for a fish to do, but I tried not to be judgmental about it. I was feeling pretty raw about my own species, and not much inclined to raise a quizzical eyebrow at others. The fish could play about in trees as much as they liked if it gave them pleasure, so long as they didn't try and justify themselves or tell each other it was a malign god who made them want to play in trees. I was feeling pretty raw about my own species because we presume to draw a distinction between what we call good and what we call evil. We find our images of what we call evil in things outside ourselves, in creatures that know nothing of such matters, so that we can feel revolted by them, and by contrast, good about ourselves. And if they won't be revolting enough of their own accord, we stoke them up with a goat. They don't want the goat, they don't need it. If they wanted one, they'd find it themselves. The only truly revolting thing that happens to the goat is in fact done by us. So, why didn't we say something like, "Don't kill the goat"? Well, there are a number of possible reasons. One, if the goat hadn't been killed for us, it would have been killed for someone else, for the party of American tourists, for instance. Two, we didn't realise what was going to happen until it was too late to stop it. Three, the goat didn't lead a particularly nice life anyway, particularly not today. Four, another dragon would probably have got it later. Five, if it hadn't been the goat, the dragons would have got something else, like a deer or something. Six, we were reporting the whole incident for the CD and the book and for the BBC. It was important that we went through the whole experience so that people would know about it in detail. That's well worth a goat. 7. We felt too polite to say, "Please don't kill the goat on our account." 8. We were a bunch of lily-livered, rationalising turds. The great thing about being the only species that makes a distinction between right and wrong is that we can make up the rules for ourselves as we go along. The fish were still hopping harmlessly up and down the tree. They were about 3 inches long, brown and black, with little bobble eyes set very close together on the tops of their heads. They hopped along using their fins as crutches. "Mudskippers," said Mark, who happened along at that moment. He squatted down to look at them. "What are they doing in the tree?" I asked. "You could say that they were experimenting," said Mark. "If they find they can make a better living on the land than in the water, then in the course of time and evolution they may come to stay on the land. They absorb a certain amount of oxygen through their skin at the moment, but they have to rush back to the sea from time to time for a mouthful of water, which they process through their gills. But that can change. It's happened before." "What do you mean?" I said. "Well, it's probable that life on this planet started in the oceans, and that marine creatures migrated onto the land in search of new habitats. There's one fish that existed about 350 million years ago that was very like a mudskipper. It came up onto the land using its fins as crutches. It's possible that it was the ancestor of all land-living vertebrates. Really? I said. What was it called? Well, I don't think it had a name at the time. So, this fish, I said, is what we were like 350 million years ago. Quite possibly. So, in 350 million years' time, one of its descendants could be sitting on the beach here with a camera around its neck, watching other fish hopping out of the sea. No idea, said Mark. That's for science fiction novelists to think about. Zoologists can only say what we think has happened so far. I suddenly felt, well, terribly old as I watched a mudskipper hopping along with what now seemed to me like a wonderful sense of hopeless, boundless, naive optimism. It had such a terribly, terribly, terribly long way to go. I hoped that if its descendant was sitting here on this beach in 350 million years' time with a camera around its neck, it would feel that the journey had been worth it. I hoped that it might have a clearer understanding of itself in relation to the world it lived in. I hoped that it wouldn't be reduced to turning other creatures into horror circus shows in order to try and ensure them their survival. I hoped that if someone tried to feed the remote descendant of a goat to the remote descendant of a dragon for the sake of little more than a shudder of entertainment, that it would feel it was wrong. I hoped it wouldn't be too chicken to say so.